Well, maybe I'll pick up a box of dong bags so we can knock boots later. It's just like this perfect, like, who says that?
Welcome to Wreckatopia, a happy home for recommended movies, TV shows, music, video games, foodstuffs, and more from three people you can definitely trust. Trustability varies by region, no guarantees implied. Now, here are your hosts, Chris Atkinson, Jeremy Scott, and Aaron Dyson.
Whiskey.
Do you mean whiskey?
What?
You're saying it weird.
Saying what weird?
All of it.
Hello, everybody. It's Wreckatopia, episode 109. My name is Chris Atkinson. I'm joined by Aaron Dyson.
Heidely ho, Cinerinos.
And I'm joined by Jeremy Scott.
I'm on the left again. I don't know what's going on, Aaron. Welcome.
Today's big recommend is Hot Rod from 2007. Once again, welcome chat coming in here on a Tuesday to watch us talk about movies. Does anybody have a small recommend?
It's no big deal. Itty-bitty
living space. It's so small and light.
It's small. It's tiny. It's petite. It's wee.
I promised you a Mountain Dew recommend. And boy, howdy, I have the mother of all Mountain Dew recommends. There are two new Mountain Dew flavors that I found in the store a week and a day ago. Baja Tropical Something and Baja Laguna Lemonade. The Tropical Something was good. I enjoyed it. It obviously was not that memorable because I can't remember what exactly. I think it was Fruit Punch. Infused dew. Now I'm gonna be honest, I like most of these alternative dew flavors. I really dislike the apple one that they sell exclusively at Kroger. Yeah, because apple doesn't go with dew.
No.
And there was one a year or so ago that was pineapple coconut pina colada. I didn't particularly care for that one. Mm-hmm. My favorite of all time is Livewire. I think I've mentioned that before. It's the orange colored, orange flavored infused. It's my very favorite dew. But guess what? It has competition. From the very first sip, I said, oh my God. And I made my wife try it. And she was like, oh, and she doesn't like sugared sodas, but she liked this. Like, I'm a big mango lemonade guy. Starbucks for years sold a mango lemonade tea. I would get it every single morning. And then they just stopped and they replaced it with some dragon fruit shit. Anyway, I'm glad to say the Mountain Dew Baja Laguna Lemonade is amazing. It is a mango lemonade infused dew. And I went looking for it again this morning in the same grocery store and it was gone. I don't know when I'm going to get to have it again. But that is, if you like Mountain Dew variants, run, don't walk. To your nearest wherever and get the Baja Laguna Lemonade. It's my second favorite dew of all time after just one bottle.
I haven't drank sugary drinks for probably 6-7 years at this point. So, but when I did, especially when I went to Taco Bell, I would always get the Baja Blast.
Oh yeah.
And holy crap, the Baja Blast was so good. Now, I don't know if it was good in bottle form because they did sell it like that rarely, I think, at one point. I don't remember the bottle form being all that good, but man, the fountain drink, ooh, good stuff.
They sell the bottle form, and they now sell a zero sugar version. Now, I grabbed one because I like Baja Blast. I don't think I like whatever Mountain Dew is using for their artificial sweetener combo. I don't think it's as close to the real thing as Coke. So I didn't drink the rest of my Baja Blast, but you might enjoy it because they do have a zero sugar version. And yeah, I only allow myself one full sugared soda a week, usually on the weekend.
So, good for you. That's a good practice.
I'll go next and just let you and I know that I saw one of the greatest documentaries I've ever seen in my life. I saw Steve Martin.
A documentary. Oh, I'm looking forward to this.
Two pieces. This is on Apple TV Plus. This is phenomenal. Like my initial response to this is stop making biopics and just start doing this kind of stuff. Like, this is so much more informative. It's so much more interesting. It's so much more complete. Even in an instance like this, where you can tell, you know, Steve Martin is very involved in the access that he's giving all of his like old material, his tapes and videos, and so there's all this reference material that I've never seen before of his career. Even with the person involved, I feel like this hits more deeply than a lot of these biopics have been hitting, especially recently. To give you the conceit of what's going on here, it's a documentary in two parts. It is two feature-length documentaries, basically, total of a little over 3 hours. So it's a little over 3 hours of your time. But the two separate pieces are completely different textured documentaries. The first one uses solely like animations and cutouts and interesting transitions and that kind of stuff. Any voiceover you hear is narration. There's not talking heads on screen. And it covers very chronologically the life of Steve Martin up to about 1980 when he quit stand-up. So it's got all of his like growing up, his magic career. He was a magician before he was a comedian. Like it's got all of that stuff in there. And then it goes into how he developed his comedic style, how the kind of core of what he wanted to do as a comedian was to eliminate indicators. So indicators are where a comedian lets you know where to laugh. You know where to laugh because it's the punchline. You know where to laugh because I do this. So there's this construct you have with the audience where it's like, insert laugh here so they laugh, whether they think it's funny or not. And he wanted to do away with any kind of indicators in his act so that people would laugh when they felt like laughing. And so you kind of see him develop that. You see him become the biggest stand-up comedian, in the history of stand-up comedians. By 1980, like, I didn't realize how big Steve Martin was as a stand-up. He was the very first comedian ever to go platinum, to sell a million albums. Wow. He was the very first comedian ever to sell out a stadium. And a lot of that is because his performance was so big. And I guess thinking back on it, you know, he had quit stand-up comedy by the time I was five. Right. So like I didn't have a lot of context for Steve Martin's stand up. But when I was in high school, 10 years, a decade after he had quit stand up, I knew what Wild and Crazy Guy was. I knew what the arrow in the head through the head. Like he had this impact, like the stuff he did, like really invaded culture in this really interesting way. It goes through the Saturday Night Live stuff. It's interesting. He's always, you know, almost like a cast member that was never a cast member because he's hosted so many times.
I was just
going to
say, one of my favorite things is when people I know find out that Steve Martin wasn't ever technically a cast member of SNL because there's so many famous.
Yeah, he's sort of a de facto cast member back in the day, you know, kind of like Alec Baldwin became a few years ago.
So that's just the first documentary. It's fascinating. It's interesting. I loved all the stuff I learned and I loved it. The second documentary starts. And it starts with Steve as he is today, and it's a completely different feel and kind of goes through his movie career as it relates to him as a human being. There's a lot of talk of what fatherhood meant to him late in life, a lot of talk about his relationships, about his art collecting, which I was very short on my knowledge on how much of an art savant he is. Like he really knows his art stuff. Man, there's just so much fascinating material here. I cannot recommend this documentary high enough. It's really, really good watch. All 3 hours. It just flew by.
Does it get into the banjo prowess?
Yes.
Excellent.
Yep. Banjo stuff is there as well.
That's one of my favorite facets of Steve Martin.
Yeah, I'll definitely be all over this. I watched his show with Martin Short when they came to Nashville.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That was really fun. He has a legendary Nashville show from Exit End days where he apparently took everybody out to McDonald's. And, you know, that's just been one of those things that like just so much lore to that at this point. And also not that this happens all the time, but you always have to be on your toes about what's going on. And like today, like if you don't like a certain stand-up comic or whatever, and it's like, maybe in a few years, people will find that genius or whatever. But Steve Martin, I remember seeing a review from Siskel and Ebert about The Jerk, which they hated. They hated The Jerk so much. And, and Roger
that's
Ebert,
that's in this documentary, the Siskel and Ebert review is. Yeah.
And Roger Ebert even made a point to say, I don't like his stand-up comedy. I don't like anything that Steve Martin's about. And basically, it's just like, it's like, I don't think, you know, I think Roger Ebert's just one person out of this whole group, but it just remember that there's some people out there doing, performing things that are actually doing something awesome, or like that most people will find awesome in later, in the later years.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff, like taking people out afterwards, that became a staple of his early shows, and then he got so big that it became dangerous and he couldn't do it anymore. And the documentary touches on everything. I was so impressed. I high recommend on this one. It's on Apple TV Plus, and I check it out as soon as you can.
Steve, so a friend of mine we did a group text, and a friend of mine was like, hey, there's this movie playing at the local Belcourt called Hundreds of Beavers. Does anybody want to see this? And I went to the website and watched the trailer, and I was like, okay, yeah, that's insane enough. I'm going to definitely want to watch this. It's basically a silent movie. There's some sound and some sound effects and occasional dialogue. Think The Artist back in the day when it came out. But this movie's like a live action cartoon. It's about a guy who sells this like apple cider, this alcohol, to the lumberjacks in the region. And one day the beavers go in and they like sort of sabotage his operation, and all the trees burn up. And there's no more lumberjacks to buy his cider. I don't think there's even any more apples to make the cider anymore. And he now has to survive, but he doesn't know how to trap animals or anything like that. So the whole movie is him becoming, is him being a terrible trapper all the way to becoming an expert trapper by the end of it. And this movie sets up so many visual gags and just keeps paying them off all the way through the movie. It starts off with him trying to kill rabbits for food, and then there's like other animals in here, and these animals are of course people in costumes, but after a while you kind of forget about that. You forget about the people being in the costumes, and you just say they're beavers, they're rabbits, they're raccoons, they're wolves. It's amazing how much they fit in this. At the first 20 minutes of this movie, I was like, there's no way they can fit a whole feature length movie of this. There's no way they can sustain it, but they keep adding gags and building on top of it and everything. This movie has a very good chance, if it's available, and I get into the 2020s of comedy, of being the big recommend, because that's how funny this movie is. I saw the trailer, but I would probably defer to Dicer on this and not watch the trailer and watch the movie without knowing anything going in, because that's going to be an even bigger surprise when you go and watch it at that point. So there you go.
I'm very excited about this movie. I immediately looked to see if it was playing in town, and I couldn't find it. I did see that it's coming out on VOD really soon. So I think maybe I even saw like April 15th or something like that.
Well, that would probably, 6 weeks from now when I'm like doing the 2020s, it might be ready for people to watch. I'm not sure, but I'm looking for it. Exactly.
I could just watch it on my own.
The question is where I saw this is I saw it at a movie theater. We have a independent theater here called the Belcourt that I saw it at, and it's currently in theaters, but the show times are staggered in such a way that says this is not going to be in theaters for very long. So it should be available to watch. Like Aaron said, it's possibly on VOD in a couple of weeks. So
nice.
All right, we're going to go on to our big recommend, which is Hot Rod from 2007. And I am very curious as to how some of you guys took this movie.
I'm fine. It's just that you're so big.
It's so huge.
It's a good rule, but this is bigger than rules.
It's bigger on the inside.
Is it?
I noticed.
But we will go through our usual spiel here and talk about the plot, as it were. the movie opens with Rod Kimball, played by Andy Samberg. He's trying to jump a mail truck on a moped, which predictably leads to his body flying off the bike and into the ramp on the other side. And the stuntman actually broke his leg on that stunt, from what I understand. And they went over to him and to see if he was okay. And he's like, "Did you get the shot?" And that's basically that's awesome. How that stunt lives his life. But unfazed, Rod is still telling people he's going to jump the pool tomorrow and hands out flyers. And we get the sense that everybody kind of thinks of Rod as a joke. So basically they're going there to see him fail. And that's what we see throughout the movie. So we now meet Rod and his friends while they hang out at, it's like a hot dog stand, hamburger stand, something like that. His brother Kevin, played by Yorma Taconi, Rico, played by Danny McBride, and Dave, played by Bill Hader. They are basically losers. At the very beginning, we see Rod is playing a game where he tastes jelly beans and comes up with the flavor, names the flavor. Dave strikes out with the hot dog stand girl. Rico comes back with some fireworks out of the bathroom that don't seem to work. So they're just that kind of a crew. And so after that, we go to Rod's home, where his parents, Frank and Marie, played by Ian McShane and Sissy Spacek, tell you about a pull to get on this movie, getting Ian McShane and Sissy Spacek on this. We find out Rod is an adopted son, while Kevin is the biological son. Rod thinks he needs to beat his father's ass to get his respect. And that becomes the ultimate driver of this movie's plot. They fight for a really long time, and his dad thoroughly beats Rod's ass. The punishment being to take out the trash, where Rod sees Mary Jane Watson, I mean Denise, played by Isla Fisher. And they have a little like, "Hey, we haven't seen each other in a while, and boy, you're sure are pretty, Isla Fisher." And she has a mysterious American accent that lapses into Australian every once in a while. So, finally, we established that Rod's father was some dude who tested out the stunts for Evel Knievel before Evel would go on and get all the glory for the stunts his dad did first. And we find out later he died trying to perform a jump over 10 milk trucks. Of course, that's going to be a lie. On to the pool jump scene, where his brother Kevin has mysteriously not shown up. And we meet an ancillary friend named Richardson, played by Chester Tam, whose main skill is breaking out into dances for no reason. Rod predictably fucks this stunt up too, and this time in front of love interest Denise. And he just splashes into the pool. He doesn't ever seem to really train to do these stunts, by the way. He just goes out and does them. And predictably they don't work out very well. After Rod splashes into the pool, he comes home to find out that his dad is actually dying and has been dying for some time. Rod asks how long has he been sick, and his mom says since 21 years ago. And he needs a heart transplant. They didn't tell him because they didn't think he could handle it. And now Rod is very motivated to earn $50,000 to save Frank with a heart transplant so he can beat his ass afterwards. Rod is so upset, he must now go to his quiet place where he reenacts Footloose. This place even has its own pommel horse. During all the jumps and dances, Rod ends up falling over a log and then crashes down a hill for 47 seconds. It's not all bad, though, because at the end of the fall, he notices a skydiving billboard that says "One Big Jump," which inspires him to create a stunt where he will jump over 15 school buses, which apparently is the record, one more than Evel Knievel did. And he looked it up on the internet and everything. Rob tells his friends that he needed to think last night, so he galloped in a wooded glen, and after punch dancing out his rage and suffering an extremely long and very painful fall, he came up with an idea that would save Frank's life. But there's not time to tell them the whole plan, because Dave's got to go to work at the ice rink. So the plan is relayed in an unbroken speech over several different locations in the ice rink, and even going back to places from earlier where they're clearly in the same poses, sending cinema sins into a sinning frenzy. Rod needs to train first and collect $5,000, mainly by doing small stunt work and children's birthday parties. This will pay for the stunt itself, the bus jump, and the crew working on it. Still in the middle of his spiel, the movie cuts to Rod's friends outside the dumpster where a homeless man is explaining his plan until Rod comes out and asks them what they're doing out there. Ultimately, Rod hopes to translate his plan into the bus jump, where he plans to get $50,000 somehow. They celebrate by popping some bubble wrap. Rod gets Denise to join by being annoying, and the crew is set. After we get to hear Rico's dream about fighting wizards by punching them in their faces, only then to suffer the indignity of all their wives wanting to have sex with him, Rod introduces Denise to the crew. Rod says, "My name is Rod, and I like to party." And everyone else follows suit, claiming they too like to party, despite Rod protesting that they need to have another thing other than partying. There's an argument, and finally Rod introduces her to the crew properly. After this is done, he says, "Let's party." Training includes being held underwater for 40 seconds, and then he gets on a skateboard sled thing where all of a sudden Rod says all the WH words with a weird H sound included, mimicking a gag from Family Guy that had taken place several months before this movie came out. This sled stunt leads to Rod smashing into a trailer and Rico beating the owner up. Anyway, the training seems to be about everything except the jump itself. Outside a convenience store, Rod's about to ask Denise out when out of nowhere, her surprise, an unmentioned boyfriend, Jonathan, played by Will Arnett, shows up and dashes his dream. Rod is clearly jealous of Jonathan, asks the hot dog stand girl out poorly, and it clearly makes Denise a little jealous. Rod's poor attempt is it successful? I don't know if it is. Hard to say, because Rod sets up a double date with Denise and Jonathan where the woman doesn't even show up. So it's, they kind of step on a joke here where his poor attempt to ask the hot dog stand girl out works, but then she doesn't show up. So I don't know what he could have been lying. I guess they don't even really go back to that. Jonathan finds an old friend to leave the scene while Rod tells Denise about the horrible way his dad died. His front tire exploded, the handlebars went through his head, his teeth ground into a powder, and the front of his face exploded out of the back of his skull, killing him instantly the next day. Now Rod enters phase two, the children's party, shown to us in montage form, and he's not very good at that either, but he's popular enough that he's making money, and he even teaches Denise how to ride the moped, where by the end, she's clearly way better than Rod, and not only riding it, but performing stunts. The montage ends with Rod being blown up in a tower in a prescient scene for Danny McBride's character in Tropic Thunder. The person paying Rod tells him, "You're a terrible stuntman," and Rod, after the explosion, asks him to repeat it, and then repeat it again, and finally Rod levels with the dude. "I heard what you said. It was just really me." Rod and Denise practice some Tai Chi out by the lake, where Denise teaches him the move where you can make someone crap your pants. Kevin shows Rod that he's been making a video of all the stunts, which gives Rod the idea to show a film in a theater that will advertise his prowess. A theater agrees, which is mind-blowing. They start passing out flyers, which is Richardson's time to shine, where he goes around throwing hundreds of flyers in people's faces and then breaking into a dance everywhere. Also, an incredible amount of people come to this show and then laugh at Rod, which leads to Rod throwing the theater's digital projector out the window, smashing into the theater manager's car, and making them give away every dollar they've earned to pay for it. And then Rod and Kevin also get into a fight. Rod learns the truth about his father, that he was not a stuntman, but a guy who worked at a tire shop, and he died during a pie-eating contest. He no longer wants to be a stuntman, and he proves his normalcy by simply going to a grocery store to shop, which is what everyday people do. They just go to grocery stores and shop. That's what you do when you're depressed about your dreams being dashed. Denise gets upset of him, but Rod explains that he was once too legit to quit, but now I'm not legit. I'm unlegit, and for that reason, I must quit. He then gets hit by a van, but it doesn't matter. You know, it's funny. Rod definitely isn't the son of a stuntman, but he certainly has the resilience of a stuntman in all of this. He gets hit by things all the time, and he never goes to the hospital, I don't think. And then Dave calls Rod and asks if he can take Dave to the hospital for some reason, a reason that is not revealed until Dave gets in the car, and we see a piece of metal sticking out of his right eyebrow, something that happened because a friend at the ice rink, who's played by the director, Akiva Schaffer, gave him some acid, and a piece of metal flew into his face while he was working on a bench grinder. And this is apparently a true story that Bill Hader contributed to the film, where a friend of his had something like this happen to him. And basically Bill was the rod in that story. So he apparently, this is his contribution to the film. Kevin and Rod reconcile, and in a stunning change in genre, they get trapped in a loop saying cool beans to each other. It's like science fiction. All of a sudden, they're just trapped saying cool, cool, beans, beans, back and forth. Kevin tells Rod that he uploaded the stunt video to YouTube, and now an AM station wants to broadcast the bus stunt, meaning this very visual thing will be broadcast on the radio. The AM station is represented by Chris Parnell, who really hates FM radio and TV. He even has a Calvin and Hobbes-esque tattoo where a guy is peeing on FM and TV at the same time, explaining that there's a blockage that allows him to pee in two different streams while AM remains safely dry far away from the scene. And Chris Parnell is great in this. Almost everything he does in this is funny. Rod talks to his dad, who in the only moment in the film where Frank isn't being a dick, tells Rod he's going to die if he goes through with this. But don't worry, he's not a dick for long. Another montage pops up, Rod doing his Tai Chi and getting oiled by a random dude in overalls. The main part of this montage is Rod walking down the street. This is my favorite part of the movie, by the way. Rod walking down the street and getting joined one by one by all the people in the movie. Then, like, everybody who sees them walking down the street joins to the tune of John Farnham's You're the Voice. It's very inspiring until someone throws a trash can into a store window, which kickstarts a full-on riot. Bedlam ensues, and even a couple making out on the hood of a car. That is how bad things get, is there's a couple making out on the top of a car. Denise breaks up with Jonathan after he runs over a raccoon and doesn't seem to care, and Jonathan says, babe, probably 20 times. At the jump, the phones are set up for donations to get the $50,000. Dave gives Rod a better motorcycle. Rico rigs the whole stunt platform with fireworks. After Rico gives encouraging words, Dave tells Rod how nervous he is, how everyone is for him. In the bathroom, he overheard someone saying how crazy this stunt is. Denise shows up and gives him a kiss, which is way too mouthy for him at first, before they correct it and get a proper one in before the jump. Dave says, is that Rod kissing his sister? And Kevin tells him Denise is not his sister. And Dave's like, man, that shatters my entire universe. The jump goes great until Rod is unseated from his motorcycle and suffers what definitely should be a fatal fall. But if you've been following Rod's exploits throughout the movie, we know he's indestructible and it does not kill him. He gets an assist from a grilled cheese and a taco in his dreams. And they are doing their best impression of Dumbledore in that Harry Potter movie that comes out a few years later. Though he probably has 20 broken bones, he has helped up the ramp where we see the $50,000 goal achieved, and Scrooge shows up with a cooked goose. And Rod does finally beat up Frank 6 months after a heart surgery. And Frank's got throwing stars. The fight crashes through the house and out into a cookout, into a neighbor's yard and their driveway. Finally, Frank gives Rod respect and the movie ends. There is an end credit scene where Rod pays respect to his bike, giving it a bow. Okay. What did you guys think of this movie?
I still love it. I loved it the first time I saw it. I love it now watching it again. I think I vibe with Sandberg's sense of humor. I think that's just primarily what it is. I think when I was watching this the first time, because it's the first time I'd seen him in a movie kind of situation, I was when the flash dance scene happened into the falling montage, I was like, oh, I'm gonna actually like this movie. That's a lot of fun. And then when the You're the Voice leading to the riots scene happened later, I was like, oh no, I love this movie. This is hilarious. So like going back and watching it, having all those laughs again was really, really good. That falling montage, like I laughed out loud through at least 30 of the 49 seconds of him falling. When he comes over the hill or the stuntman or whoever's doing it, in some sort of quadruple horizontal spin, it just slays me. Like it's just, there's this idea of what humor means to him that is progressive, where it's just like you keep one-upping yourself outside of reality, right? Like you find reality's line and then you push it so far that you can just do whatever and, you know, it somehow stays funny. maintains the hilarity, at least for me. There's another scene like that where they're imitating a bell around a pool, and it's just them imitating a bell for like 30 seconds, and it's the funniest thing I've ever seen. And that was all improvised. Like, that was just something they did, you know? They just shot it, and they were like, that's really funny. Let's keep it in the movie. I love that kind of stuff. You mentioned a lot of the scenes that I would call back to. The I will forget it just slays me every time. I think there is one character for me that almost steals the show, and it's Will Arnett as Jonathan. He has some things. He is the perfect character for what they're representing there. He has this moment where they're at dinner and he sees somebody and he says, "Hey, Sullivan, you chode, I owe you a shot in the nuts." And it's just the way he delivers it is so perfect. And that line is so perfect. He has another time he tells her, "Well, maybe I'll pick up a box of dong bags so we can knock boots later." And it's just like this perfect, like, who says that? Well, he does. Jonathan says that. And Will Arnett just has that aura about him of that, you know, smarmy Boston guy, whatever. And then I do like the babe, no, no. Like, that just goes on for all the amount of amazingness. You mentioned the radio tattoo, which I love as somebody who's been in radio and, you know, feels that push of technology past what, you know, you're doing and, you know, trying to figure out how to survive. So all that stuff was fun. And I think this movie actually does have a little bit to say. There's some interesting things here on toxic masculinity, the idea of, you know, fathers and sons, like beating up your father is such a metaphor for, you know, so much of what movies do with fathers and sons. You're the voice scene is actually a really interesting commentary on how nothing can be good, how we just can't be trusted with good things. Like, even the best of intentions lead to humans just taking advantage and, you know, being complete jerks about it. So the movie has some things to say, some interesting things to say. It's not intent on like driving them home, but they're definitely underneath the comedy there, which I always find interesting as well. So yeah, I had a really good time with it again. I think this movie's really funny and I really enjoyed it.
I might have been in a bad mood when I saw it initially. I had a blast with this. I don't think it all works for me as well as it does for you guys, but I laughed out loud a bunch, and that's all I can ask a comedy to do for me. The opening stunt going wrong, the way that that guy's body ragdolls over the truck and into the other ramp was my first laugh out loud. You mentioned, Aaron, you guys both talked about the Thinking Place dance scene that turns into a 47-second fall down the mountain, which I was laughing out loud at the entire time like you, Aaron. But my favorite part is the end, because he falls and it's over and it cuts to like a wide shot of a mountain and a shot of a cloud. And then you just see... his body was flying across, and it's not over yet, and I lost it. I thought that the line, "You look pretty," what was that? I said, "You look shitty. Good night, Denise." The awkwardness of the way that Sandberg plays this character was great. I noted, like you did, Chris, exactly how many movies is Danny McBride in where he blows up the explosives too soon? And for all I know, one is a callback to the other. I don't know. I love the dancing guy throwing the flyers everywhere, because he's in the background in a couple shots where you almost have to look for him, because he's not always overt and in your face. The ice rink planning montage, you guys have already hit all the high points. I don't know how they sell out that theater to show that movie. Like you said, I don't know how they even get permission to show that movie. I loved the Cool Beans breakdown, and I think that is the most Lonely Island thing in the whole movie, because it turns into a song and completely steps out of the movie for a moment just for an odd joke. The babe, babe, babe thing does not make me laugh as much as it does you guys, because to me it felt like a rehash of that Cool Beans joke, only without the music. But I get why that's funny, even though it wasn't super hilarious to me. I love the random stuff. I wish this movie had more non sequitur humor. Like, we cut to the TV and it's a news lady saying the dog walked itself home, ate a pizza, and took a nap.
Which, by the way, it I love when movies get actual reporters to do this type of stuff, because when they get actors to do reporters, they can never get it right.
Right.
They never get the reporting right. So when they got an actual reporter to say those words, it's so much funnier.
There's also another throwaway line when they're filling up the pool and the camera's just kind of panning along. And I think it's Danny McBride that says, man, pools are perfect for holding water. that slayed me. I really enjoyed it. I had a great time. I don't know what was wrong with me when I saw it the first time. Although I do think it is the kind of humor. It is that kind of just dumb for the sake of dumb sometimes humor that I'm just going to chalk it up to the wrong mindset. When I watched it, maybe I was expecting more of a scripted, like traditional straightforward comedy or something. But you know, I went looking for double features and thought of dozens of movies that are like this that I like. So I'm just going to throw this into the pile with those.
This movie certainly isn't perfect, and there's a reason why it wasn't a big hit, and it's gotten a sort of a cult following since, but there's a lot of things that I think because of their limitations, and again, you can't absolve a movie because of its limitations, but I think because of the limitations, there are a lot of things that go undeveloped and they step on jokes quite a bit in this. And there are things that could have been a lot better, but the structure of this movie is really weird too. Like how there's some things in it that they could have, I think with a little bit more time, they could have done. Will Arnett, by the way, is only there for 2 days of filming. So that's the reason why he has his whole thing is very limited. It's one of my most hated cliches in movies to have this sweet doll of a girl dating someone like this. You see that in movies like The Wedding Singer and Wedding Yep. Crashers, and it's like, what did you ever see in this person in the first place that you don't seem like you're a material person, so you're not dating this person because they're rich, and they're always inevitably rich people. Mm-hmm. You're not dating them because of that. You're dating them because of something you saw in them, and I don't see what it is. They're dicks all the time, so I never get that. But it's one of those movies that's got just a ton of moments that you're going to remember afterward. The other thing after that, you're the voice riot scene that gets me every time is after they run away from the riot scene, they're all sitting there going, oh man, that seems so positive. And then it turned into something so negative and everything. And Danny McBride sitting there holding a TV that he has looted. And he's like, yeah, man. The best thing to do is just leave and get it and make sure that you just feel good that you're okay. And all that. And they're all just kind of like, yeah, nodding and everything. The guy stole a TV. If they could have done that a lot more, that this would have been, I don't know if it would have been a hit. It's just one of those movies that I don't think the premise of it, drags people into theaters, but I think it certainly would have been a little bit better with some more time to refine some of these jokes. The first 11 minutes of this movie have just very tiny laughs for a while. And I, when I was watching this again, I was like, oh no, I know there's other stuff coming, but I'm like, oh man, this first 11 minutes has just like a couple of things that are kind of funny. And it's just trying to establish the story and everything. And it's so it doesn't get sidetracked with all the goofiness that's coming later. But anyway, all right. Let's see what you guys have for your super secret double feature on this one.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Shh. Be very, very quiet.
Secret? What secret?
Our dirty little secret.
I tell you something I've never told anyone.
All right. Well, I feel like if you want to match the tone of this film, then there are really not very many surprises, I don't think, that I could choose. I thought of a lot of silly comedies that are dumb. And that's what I'm going with. But I think there's a lot of connections between Hot Rod and Happy Gilmore. There's something very Adam Sandler-like to the way that Sandberg occasionally sings in this movie about what he's doing. Going on a date, and I'm going to a date. Very reminded me very much of Adam Sandler. Sandler in that movie has to save his grandma's house, just like Hot Rod has to raise money for his dad, or stepdad's surgery. Sandler fights with an old man in Happy Gilmore. There's occasional shocking violence, occasional silliness. I just think it matches up on too many points, even though it is, in my own opinion, a fairly obvious pick. I went with Happy Gilmore.
Nice.
I picked this Super Secret double feature before watching the documentary. Mine is The Jerk.
The Jerk.
I think there's a really interesting comparison of Steve Martin's comedy, early comedy career, to what people like Andy Samberg do with pushing the lines and kind of taking humor. We talk about the Cool Beans scene and just like not worrying about keeping it realistic or whatever to some of the things that Steve Martin did. It's also a story about discovering who you really are in relation to your adopted family. Of course, Steve Martin realizes he's not a black child and has to find out who he really is. And so, you know, and it has that silly humor with he's shooting at the cans, you know, and stuff like that. There's cans over here too. And like that scene goes on so long with different, you know, areas where there are cans. It reminded me a lot of, you know, kind of that kind of sense of humor where you just keep pushing something because it's silly and funny. And, so yeah, I see. And then watching the documentary, I actually, thinking a lot closer about Steve Martin's career and him, how he pushed the envelope as a comedian, thought a lot about Andy Samberg and kind of the way that they've, you know, deconstructed comedy to not, you know, depend on certain run-of-the-mill things that comedy usually does. So yeah, I went with The Jerk for my double feature.
And I love that pick for a variety of reasons. And yeah, The Jerk is great. I don't know what Siskel and Ebert were thinking. I heard them deconstruct scenes in it, and I was like, no, you're absolutely wrong about the comedy structure of this scene. I know it's subjective, but you're wrong quite a bit. I remember when this movie came out, Andy Samberg, going back to your double feature, Jeremy, Andy Samberg said that he wanted to do something kind of like old Adam Sandler, when he did this. You know, because old Adam Sandler, I'm going to only say there's really two movies that qualify for that. And that's Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. The other ones, he started getting $20 million paychecks. And the comedy started getting a little bit. Yeah, there was an aversion to risk in a lot of these big movies that he started coming out with. The Waterboy kind of gets in that insanity, but it's like it's the tipping point for him where like all the comedies after that become just more like regular. They're not nearly as funny, I don't think. But I think that's an interesting thing. The other interesting thing about this movie, too, this was credited to Pam Brady, who's a South Park writer, and I think the entire Lonely Island ended up coming in and just changing this entire script. So while Pam Brady is the credited writer on this, and she is a South Park writer, and it makes a lot of sense when you watch this movie, she doesn't apparently have much. I don't know how much is left out of all of this. It basically became a Lonely Island feature.
I was absolutely positive that the guy pouring oil on him in that quick cut was Will Forte until we were halfway through the show and I looked it up. And it's not Will Forte.
It does seem like a Will Forte thing, doesn't it?
It looks kind of like him, too.
All right. The homework for next week, it's Aaron's turn to pick. What do you say, Aaron?
Let's go all the way back to 2016 again with Sing Street.
Ooh, I love this movie.
I've been wanting to revisit this, and I haven't seen it since then. So this is one of those movies that I look at and I go, you've only watched this once. You should watch it again. So... I wanted to get it on the list because I remember absolutely adoring it. I think it's my favorite of his films. So So yeah.
Yeah, John Carney.
Yeah.
Google says this is for free on Tubi and Pluto TV. I'm so glad you picked this because this is on my list of shame, but I've seen Begin Again, one of his other movies, three times, and I adore it. So I have no doubt I'm going to enjoy this. I know this has even more acclaim than Begin Again, and I might never have actually slotted it in had you not brought it up for this show. So thank you. I'm very excited about it.
Cool.
And then and I would say that if you like Begin Again, you'll like this because Carney has a very succinct, like, this is how I'm going to do these movies. You know, there's hardly ever any like real conflict in these movies. They're just very nice movies about musicians a lot of times, and this is very good too. So
awesome.
So yeah, I mean, looking forward to watching this again as well. All right, do we have time for some questions?
Question.
I got something to say.
I want the truth.
I'm listening.
In the movie In Time with Justin Timberlake, money has been replaced as currency by time. What is a non-money currency that you think might take over in the future? And apparently you guys said I stole the best answer. I'm happy to hear that.
Yeah, go ahead. You go ahead and answer this question, and I'll go on top of it.
Yes, well, Jeremy, go first.
My first thought was water.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That is the answer.
I feel like...
Yeah, and has already been a currency. Kind of inevitable. And so, yeah.
Yeah.
In kind of... Mad Max.
So, well, yeah. That's for sure.
Yeah, I would also say if you're in a society where water is currency, then drugs are going to be currency too. So, you know, that's just the way it goes.
I'm going to say Liquid Death's Rest in Peach because I cannot get any of that. They keep saying they're out of stock. So, I think that'll eventually replace Bitcoin.
I think you're right.
Bitcoin. In Waterworld, it was dirt.
Don't forget. That's fair.
It could very well just be
dry dirt. Land exists. I've seen it.
Not a myth. What's a movie that was a surprise to win an award that when you watched it later made you think, yeah, that deserved the award? Thought came after watching Poor Things with Emma Stone being the sort of surprise win over Lily Gladstone. Gentlemen.
When Tom Hanks won for Philadelphia, I was rooting very hard for Liam Neeson in Schindler's List. And I was super disappointed because I was very much about like everybody in Schindler's List. I wanted Ralph Fiennes to win too, but Tommy Lee Jones won for The Fugitive. But then watching Tom Hanks in Philadelphia, it's really probably deserving of the award. It was a really tough category too. They had Lawrence Fishburne was in What's Love Got to Do with It, Daniel Day-Lewis in The Name of the Father, Anthony Hopkins, Remains of the Day. That was a tough, tough category in 1993 or 1994, if you prefer. I don't.
The disdain. And so,
yeah, exactly. I fucking hate it. Anyway, when you go look at Tom Hanks's performance, there's a lot of things going on in that. That's the best he's ever been, I think, and don't think he's been better since. So that's what I'll go with.
That's a good answer.
It's a weird question for me because it's been a while since I can remember not having seen it when the awards happened. So the way the timing of the question is phrased is a little weird. Like you go back and then you watch it and you're like, oh yeah, they deserve that. But the most recent one that I remember thinking, wow, what a surprise, and I think that's right, is Olivia Colman winning for The Favorite. She was not expected to win that year, and that performance is so good. Like, she is so good in that movie. And I was like, yeah, right on. That's the right choice.
Who was supposed to win that year? Because I swore
it's a great question.
She was going to, so I don't know.
Jeremy, you want to go, and I'll look it up?
Sure. Spotlight won Best Picture before I ever got around to watching it. I think I saw it on the movie channels. And at the time, I just didn't understand how a drama about a newspaper investigation could beat out something visceral like The Revenant or even Mad Max, which was nominated. And then obviously when I later saw the movies, I learned some lessons about judging a book by its cover because Spotlight is incredible. And, you know, that made me jump into other newspaper investigation movies that weren't as good. But yeah, no, Spotlight was the one to me. And I was like, okay, good for you guys. And then when I saw it, I was like, oh, yeah.
It looks like that was supposed to be the Glenn Close coronation year. She had won all the awards leading up to it, and everybody was just expecting her to win. Yeah.
In the chat, we have Eileen Brennan and Private Benjamin. And then we have, I was rooting for How to Train Your Dragon best score, but in hindsight, appreciated the Social Network score. Yeah, that's a good one. All right. One more, maybe? One more question?
One more. I'm going to skip the third, Aaron, and go to the fourth. Favorite movie moments where sound becomes its own thing, character moment, draw, etc.
Or the lack of, as in A Quiet Place, which I think is probably one of the more unique experiences I've ever had in a movie theater, because every movie that you go to, people, you know, it's like, oh, I'm just going to kind of whisper, and you know, people whisper and they think that they can't be heard, that it's not annoying. I don't know what's going on with that, but in A Quiet Place, nobody did that. Nobody whispered or even as much wanted to crinkle one of their candy bags when they were, I mean, they may not even wanted to go eat anything during A Quiet Place. So the character of A Quiet Place, any kind of sound whatsoever where the audience themselves doesn't want to do any sound at all. I thought that was an extremely amazing experience.
My answer is pretty much the entire movie of The Sound of Metal. There's some really interesting sound design in that movie, but specifically the moment after he has the operation, the way they used his oral, I don't know how, like A-U-R-A-L, sense of perspective was really interesting to me. So yeah, that's what came to mind, was how great Sound of Metal uses sound.
You guys answered this question better than I did. I was thinking about like specific moments as opposed to like movies that used sound really well. So I was thinking in The Town when they're doing the robbery of Fenway and the cops throw that flashbang in and like the movie audio itself goes and everything gets super quiet and takes a while to come back in, exactly how humans' ears would respond to that situation. That's why flashbangs are effective. And then I also, again, another movie moment that was like that is The Last Jedi, when they do that Holdo maneuver and light speed through the other ship and the sound goes out for most of that actual action. And it's incredible. It's one of my favorite movie moments ever. A movie that I generally don't really like. So, there you go. I think that'll do it. Do we have any answers in the chat?
Over in the chat, we have the music fight in Doctor Strange 2.
Yes!
Alien, definitely a great sound design in Alien. No doubt about it. Flyboy says, them, the ant movie. You can hear the giant ant striation several times before we see them, and it's eerie as hell. And then, if it's just a moment, the end of Children of Men with the war going on, and they are walking out. Yeah. Very, very good. All right. Well, that's going to do it for this week. Next week is Sing Street. Can't wait to talk about that again. Chat, once again, thank you so much for coming out on a Tuesday. We may not be here on a Tuesday next week.
Yeah, we're kind of playing it by ear. It'll either be Tuesday or Wednesday next week.
And we'll definitely get a live show. I'm sorry to say this at this moment. I just thought about this. May not be even Wednesday either.
There you go. We'll figure it out. We'll let you guys know.
We will figure it out and tell you on the various things where we will be live next week, but hopefully Tuesday. But if not, whatever. We'll figure it out. All right. It's going to be the end of it. So we'll see you.
Bye.
Part of the live show by being a member of the Sin Club at Patreon at patreon.com/cinemasins. Chat with us on the CinemaSins Discord at discord.gg/cinemasins or CinemaSins Twitter at CinemaSins, and email any comments or questions to recotopia@cinemasins.com. That's recotopia@cinemasins.com.
I was just reading a fascinating article that really helped educate me and expose how ignorant I am. about the history of the caddies at Augusta National. Because when the club opened, it was like in the 1930s when they started doing the Masters tournament. So everything was segregated. So, like, you could only play if you were white, and you could only caddy if you were black. And this was intended to be, like, discriminatory, right? You're not good enough to play. You're only good enough to carry my clubs. But over the years, these caddies became so familiar with this golf course, they became indispensable to these golfers. Jack Nicklaus won 5 Masters tournaments with the same black caddy that wasn't on his payroll. This guy just worked at Augusta National every Masters. And they ended up creating a school so that the second generation of caddies could come in with knowledge of how to caddy that they had had to learn along the way. This article had color photos of like a young Arnold Palmer and Ben Hogan alongside these relatively obscure, anonymous black caddies who arguably helped them win. There's an interview with Fuzzy Zeller, his first Masters appearance ever, he won. And he didn't know anything about the course. And he credits the entire win to this caddy that knew the course better than him. And then once the money got big and the players started building entourages around themselves, like nutritionists and workout people and swing doctors, they wanted to bring their own people with them to the Masters. And so the Masters eventually dropped the rule that you couldn't have any outside caddies. And that basically drove the original best caddies at Augusta National out of business. I thought it was fascinating. I didn't know almost any of what I read in that article. It was all new information. My dad sent it to me, actually. But anyway, I thought that was fascinating.
It's just like there's so many things that have happened in the world, and to know them all would be impossible.
Well, it's because we don't ever go into other areas. Like, we'll hear about, you know, the main things like the sit-ins and all these, you know, the protests,
right,
and the police coming out with fire hoses and all that. We hear about those type of things, but we don't hear about how it affected everyday life, all the different things that were out there. Cause we just kind of assume that sports was kind of it didn't have the same rules, or protected from all that stuff that was going on out there.
Yeah. This article said that even the PGA Tour was whites only until the 60s, somewhere in the mid 60s, which matches up with the civil rights movement. But I don't think about that because, again,
it's just like how the first time you ever hear about Jackie Robinson, the first time I heard about Jackie Robinson was like, oh, isn't that awesome? He broke the color barrier. And that is why we think about Jackie Robinson today. And he did. However, there's so many other aspects to it. Of course, the movie 42 covered a lot of that too, but you know, I think Jackie Robinson has been given this, you know, like, well, he was nice all the time. He just took it like a man or whatever, that type of thing. And he was out there very outspoken, even past the time that he was playing. He was outspoken about all sorts of issues, and something that you just never learn until later.
Yeah.
Even earlier
in a particular state, probably
last year, I think Patrick was telling me about, like, he had done all this deep dive research about, like, Jackie Robinson isn't even technically the first professional black baseball player.
No.
But it was also like, there was also some intended discrimination. Like, the whites who were racist wanted Jackie Robinson to break the color barrier in a weird way to like stop the flow of black players, like to be the one and only one. Like, they were still intent on trying to keep black people out of the game, even while admitting Jackie Robinson into the game. It's just, like you said, it's really complicated, and it's nothing is as simple as the textbook makes it seem.
Have you ever seen Ken Burns Baseball?
Yeah, but it's been ages.
He found photos of black players back in like the early 20th century.
Wow.
Maybe even the late 19th century, he even had pictures. And there's even a really sad one too, where it shows one of the black players, and he's being made fun of and everything. And he comes back to the dugout and says, God, please take this black skin off of me or something like that. Oh. Because he was so upset over what he, you know, what he had been ridiculed for and everything. Ken Burns' baseball is really good. It's like a great historical thing. It's kind of outdated now because the interviews are in the early to mid 90s, and so many things have happened since. And he came out with the 10th inning or something like that. So like after that, where he discussed some of the later things that had occurred, but I don't think he's updated it since. So there's so many things that have gone on since then. So
I heard some of that same logic after Obama got elected. Oh, we checked that one off. We don't need, mm-hmm. we got our black president, and you know, like mm-hmm. there are people that voted that way for that reason.
Well, and it just feels like every day I learn there are actually more Americans that still feel that way than I realized. Like mm-hmm. no matter how high the number gets, it keeps getting higher. It's depressing.
I remember being in New York, and there was a guy who was like, I just don't think the country's ready yet, when Obama was.
Wow.
And I was like, okay, so when do you declare it ready then? Is there some sort of magical thing that happens?
Was he like, it will only be ready when my racist generation dies off?
Yeah, I guess so.
Only when I'm gone and my racist mm-hmm. tendencies have left with me.
I used to think the racists were going to die off, Aaron.
No. Well, it's unfortunate, but cycles repeat themselves. Yeah.
No, they just raised little racists.
I think when you're dealing with any kind of caste system or any kind of prejudice in a big society, you can look at our 200-year history and the trauma we inflicted on an entire group of people just because of their skin color. The remnants of that are not generational. They are beyond. I mean, they are generational in that they continue to pass from generation to generation. You look at other societies. You know, I mean, look at Israel, Palestine. Like, you don't have to look very far to go, this stuff lasts forever, man. Like, it just keeps getting passed down and. Yeah. It's, you know, it's sad on sad's way too small of a word, obviously, on a macro level. And so you're just left to be on a micro level going, how do I be the best person I can be to the people in my life, despite gender, sexual orientation, race, whatever? You know, you can only control the environment that you walk around in.
And my wife and I had an unintentionally philosophical lunch about this the other day where we were talking about, like, there's just so much going on that is wrong in the mm-hmm. world that if I were to actually allow myself to emotionally process all of it, I would be unable to move. I would be unable to live my life. It's just, it's deadening. And there's so much evil that it almost forces you to put up walls just so you can eat, sleep, wake up, shower, get through the goddamn day. It's like you can't process all of it because it's too much.
No, you just have to hope that when you know what it's the serenity prayer, like things I can control and the things that I can't, you know, like that when you kind of get into that mindset of focusing on the things you can control, that you also don't then become oblivious to things you can't. Like, you have to remain aware of the things you can't control while only controlling the things you can. And it's mental gymnastics, and it's, you know.
It is. This is real cheery. I'll take fodder.
Well, you want me to make you even more happy? Not that I'm going to tell you anything you don't know, but I've popped back on Instagram recently for reasons. And there was an ad in, you know, my Instagram for somebody on a reel or something saying you can make $450 a day and here's how. And the how was to find these jobs writing for websites where they hire you for, you know, $150, $200, you know, a pop to write, you know, use AI to do it. And then they were selling a secondary AI that makes the language of ChatGPT even more distinct. Like, it was a 1-2 AI to AI process, and they're advertising this as the way to have a living. Is like, I just like the world we are in store for. We are not ready. There's no way to be ready for what's going to happen in the next 20 years with computer intelligence. It's just, it's wild to me, just as an observer.
Maybe the Terminator was right. We weren't going to destroy ourselves by giving robots access to weapons, just to our just everyday life. That's how the Terminator becomes symbolic of what's going on in this world and everything. Meanwhile, James Cameron, I bet James Cameron like unironically uses AI for things.
Oh, I bet he does.
You know, it's like, oh, the new technology. Ooh, boy, I'm going to totally forget about that stuff that I talked about in the Terminator.